Dr. Plato, welcome to this special podcast of Science Friday from sciencefriday.com.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Joe Palca. Ira Flato is away. Every once in a while, it makes sense to take a deep breath and take stock of where you are. That's what the editors of Science Magazine have just done. To celebrate the journal's 125th birthday, the editors came up with 125 unsolved mysteries of science. These are the big questions, the ones that researchers are focusing on. In this hour, we'll talk about some of those big questions. During the hour, we'll be joined by experts in anthropology, aging, and astronomy. I guess that means we'll hit topics beginning with B in another show, as well as the editor-in-chief of Science. And we're interested in hearing your thoughts on the big questions facing science, so give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. If you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. And now let me introduce my first guest. Donald Kennedy is the editor-in-chief of the journal Science in Washington, D.C. He joins me today from NPR Studios in Washington. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Kennedy.
Thanks very much.
So you sat down with your editors and you came up with 125 questions, but you picked 25 that you think can be answered in the next 25 years. Was it hard to come up with lists, either the big list or the smaller list?
Well, that may be a little triumph of hope over reality. I think there's certainly questions that we hope to see wonderful progress on, and they're really exciting. And the process of trying to identify them with all my colleagues and our board of reviewing editors, which is about 100 scientists who work with us, it was a really fascinating exercise looking for the blank spaces.
Did it give you a perspective on where we are in the world of science writ large?
Well, it gave me a personal perspective that was a little dampening, because it made me realize once again how much I don't know about many fields. And it was a great learning experience personally in that regard. But as far as the science is concerned, it was a real challenge to pick out the biggest 25, because all 125 are interesting and exciting.
Do you think that any scientifically literate person should be able to understand the nature of the question that's being asked in each of these questions, or are some of these so esoteric that you never know?
I absolutely agree with the second point. They're very hard. I mean, the question, for example, whether we can unify the field of physics, going beyond general relativity, encompassing the behavior of quanta, is a question that is very difficult to describe even as a question.
Yeah. And I wonder, is there a time when you feel a question is answered? I mean, if this exercise was 100 years ago, would there be questions that we've answered now 25 years later? I'm sorry, 25 years ago, that would be questions that we've answered now 25 years later.
Somebody, I think a playwright, made an unkind remark about science that it's terribly good at substituting unimportant answerable questions for important unanswerable ones. And there's a sense in which we look for targets that are attainable, and I think there are, for many questions, points in time at which you can really say, we got it. But the big questions, certainly our big 25, are going to be very, very difficult to untangle. We had a symposium yesterday afternoon. That's what you do on birthdays in a journal.
Uh-huh.
And I drew the short straw among the living editors and ex-editors, and I got to moderate the cosmos section. Hmm. Well, I mean, it was a wonderful discussion. We had Vera Rubin, who is largely responsible for the first identification of dark matter, which is a large percentage of the universe, but we can't see it because we only know it when it passes in front of bright stuff. And it was extraordinary, but it reminded me not only how little I know, but how much we have to learn, for example, about dark energy and why it is that the universe is expanding at an accelerating rate, not just flat out expanding, but going faster all the time.
Well, I'd like to bring on my next guest who joins us to answer or to address one of the questions that you raised. How did cooperative behavior evolve? Meredith Small is the author of Kids, How Biology and Culture Shape the Way We Raise Our Children, published in 2001 by Doubleday. She's a professor of anthropology at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and she joins me by telephone from Ithaca. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Small.
It's great to be here, Joe.
So let's go to that question. Why is cooperation, the issue of cooperative behavior and evolution, why is it hard for cooperation to fit into evolutionary theory?
Well, historically, in the behavioral sense, first of all, I just want to say I think it's great that the first question that you're addressing is a behavioral one rather than one of the other sciences. But historically, and I'd say, let's say for like the last 30 years or so, everyone was interested in animal behavior in what is easily known as the selfish gene. All kinds of behavior must have evolved to be selfish. And then people started noticing that there were lots of behaviors that wasn't so selfish. First of all, altruism, how did that evolve? We came up with the answer that it had to do with kin selection, that when you saw these rather nice behaviors, it must be because these animals were related to each other. And now we've discovered in the last 10 years or so that there are lots of behaviors in which they are not kin. And so we see a switch to wondering about the nice behaviors. How did the nice behaviors evolve?
What's the advantage to an individual about nice behaviors? Why would anybody be nice to anybody?
Well, one possibility is that it's a simple business of tit for tat. You do something nice for me today, and I'll do something nice for you tomorrow. And if we are animals that have a really good memory, and we happen to be animals that are socially living, and you know, you can do something 3 days ago, and I'll remember a week from now, that system can work out really well. But so you don't have to be related to do that. But there are also behaviors in which it doesn't look like it's tit for tat. It really does look like cooperation. And I think the answer is, to answer this one of the top 25 questions, is that it has to do with really the good of everybody. When you're a socially living species, it looks like everyone's interested at some level. If we all do this together, it can work out. And I don't think it's a surprise that we're interested in this right now. I mean, as we know from the past hour of Science Friday, there's a lot of conflict in the world. Well, how do we resolve that conflict? What part of the natural tendencies of humans and other animals can we encourage to be cooperative?
Now, if people... Dr. Kennedy, go ahead.
Well, I just want to compliment Dr. Small on a really elegant explanation, and she's judiciously avoiding telling us something I know she knows very well, which is that one of the nice stories out of animal behavior about reciprocal altruism comes from studies on vampire bats, which turn out to reward people who have previously shared meals with them in a way that we probably shouldn't describe. But it shows the value of tit for tat in the animal world as well as in human engagements.
But what I was going to ask Dr. Small is, what about the, you know, doesn't this open the door for cheaters, you know, for tit for tat until you turn your back and then you dive in?
Sure, but you know, cheaters don't do well in the long run. They might get away with a little bit. I know the work from primatology and monkeys who sneak behind a tree and sneak a copulation, but eventually they'll get caught. And when they're caught, they're punished, and punished badly. So cheating doesn't work really well for the long term in a social species where everybody knows each other.
Interesting. And what do you think? You said that you had the answer to this question, but what do you really think are the possibility of getting at the root of this in the next 25 years? Or is it already answered to your satisfaction?
I think the thing we're missing right now is... it's going to be the obvious answer. We need more data, and everyone will say that. But the kind of data we need is very difficult to get, and that is people have to go out and watch animals, and they have to watch people. And one of the things we don't know about is the cross-cultural human behavior. I think it's interesting that right now we have this interest in cooperative behavior in the United States or in Western culture. And this bounces off the ideology of Western culture of everyone being supposed to be self-interested and selfish, and that's sort of what we do in this country. If you were Japanese, we would have been interested in cooperative behavior a long time ago, as the Japanese primatologists were with macaques and with chimpanzees. And so I think we need to look at especially human behavior across cultures. What are differences and what are similarities? Are there universals, or are there more culturally derived behaviors?
Okay. I think we have time for one quick question, so let's go to Mike. Mike, welcome to the program from Ithaca, New York.
Hi, Dr. Small. Hi, Ira. Let me turn off my gizmo because I'm time delay and I forgot about it. Okay. I think the answer, at least in primates, as to why cooperative behavior evolved is you can get around the prisoner's dilemma, which is essentially how can it be selected for to be the good guy if you might get suckered. As long as you have some way of knowing the other guy's going to do the same thing you're going to do, then the best thing to do is put your best foot forward. And when tit for tat or kin selection is the solution to the problem, is because these provide ways of knowing the other guy's going to do what you're going to do. But I think there's an additional factor that arises in primates and other intelligent animals, and this may include birds and insects and other mammals. You know, we underestimate their intelligence. And I think is once the animal is aware that it has a mind or an existence of some kind, and it can see that the other guy is the same thing that it is, and so it's aware of the other mind's problem, that the other minds can exist, then the idea of harm coming to another being like itself is such an anathema. It's sort of like watching a horror movie and you see a movie of the Earth being destroyed by a comet or something, and it's so horrible to contemplate the destruction of something like yourself that you don't want to do it, and it makes you put your best foot forward to protect the other guy because he is what you are.
What did you make of that question, Dr. Small?
I think it's a really interesting one. I think for the last 30 years in which we've been focusing on the selfish gene, we've sort of forgotten about emotion, personality, those kind of processes, which also, along with cooperation, are becoming a focus of animal behavior studies. And that's why we have to look at not just primates, not just social primates, but other kinds of animals as well, because I think we've often underestimated what these animals, not just what they do, but what they feel and what they think.
Okay. Meredith Small, just before you, before we have to say goodbye to you, I thought I'd give you a chance to ask or add to the science's list. Are there issues in social science that you feel should have made the list that didn't?
Well, there are lots of them, but I think my personal favorite would be interpersonal interaction. A lot of the studies have been done on males and females, and it always is in the realm of sex. I'd like to see some more research on just interpersonal interaction and communication. We think we understand each other so well, but I don't think we do. So that would be my personal favorite.
Okay. Meredith Small, thanks very much for joining me this
afternoon.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you. Meredith is the author of Kids, How Biology and Culture Shape the Way We Raise Our Children, out in 2001 by Doubleday. She's also a professor of anthropology at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Dr. Kennedy, you'll remain with us, I hope, for the rest of the hour.
Absolutely.
Good. So now I'd like to go to some of our callers because we're getting a lot of interesting calls. I'll just remind everyone that our number is 800-989-8255. And first I'd like to go to Richard in Los Gatos, California. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you, Joe. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Fine. Go ahead.
Great. I actually really loved Mike's response there. It was just wonderful bringing up the prisoner's dilemma. Because of its quantum connection, in that there's studies underway on how quantum physics can be used to essentially compute optimal solutions of types of problems like that. And it just tied in so beautifully with what Donald was talking about in terms of the cosmic scale, things like dark energies and the continued acceleration of expansion of the universe. And of course the dark energies are associated with Higgs fields and virtual particles which create entanglement, and we're essentially swimming in an ocean of this, and it's one of those things that boomerangs back to what Mike was talking about in terms about the oneness of everything,
right?
Because the universe is a fully entangled object. So to my question...
Okay, then, good. Yeah, I was going
to
say.
To the question, which is, this is also multidisciplinary, especially as it relates to issues of consciousness. And we're seeing in some sectors, like in Berkeley, the formation of multidisciplinary organization like BeQuic, which is trying to solve some of these problems by not taking a very provincial point of view of specific sciences, but actually looking across multiple disciplines simultaneously to try to come up with some answers.
Interesting.
And, could the speakers, panelists, discuss that topic?
Excellent. A good question, Richard. Thank you very much. Dr. Kennedy, what about that? I mean, do we need multidisciplinary work to crack some of these problems that you've addressed?
I think that's where almost everybody is headed. I'm not quite sure that quantum theory and consciousness can be merged at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But the speaker's point about what is called the problem of non-locality or entanglement is very interesting. Among other things, it makes it possible for quantum computing, at least in principle and in theory, to do much more, because it's possible for an item to exist in two states, not just zero and one, but some combination of them.
All right. Well, we're ready with another guest to discuss another one of your big questions. This question is, how much can human lifespan be extended? And to help us answer that question, or at least say where we are with that question, is Stephen Austad. He's the author of Why We Age, What Science is Discovering About the Body's Journey Through Life, published in 1997 by Wiley. He's a professor in the Barship Institute for Longevity and Aging Studies at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. He joins me by phone from San Antonio. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Austad.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Oh, good. So where are we with this question about how far life can be extended? Do people have a pretty clear idea about that?
No, there's lots of disagreements. I think the only emergent agreement is that we're starting to understand aging so thoroughly in animal systems that it's inconceivable to me that we're not ultimately going to be able to slow the aging rate in humans.
Is there a theoretical upper limit?
Not that I can tell. I mean, there's an empirical upper limit that we've reached in animals. The longest we've been able to do is sort of increase animal lifespan by 6 to 7-fold. But that's pretty dramatic. Now, I don't think we're going to be able to do that in humans in the foreseeable future, but sort of slowing the aging rate by 50% seems to me something that's eminently doable.
Hmm. What animal were you able to extend the lifespan by 6 to 7 times?
This little worm, C. elegans, we call it, it's only about the size of a comma on a page. But remarkably, changing just a single DNA letter in the 100 million of its alphabet extends the life in one of the sexes more than 6-fold, which I find absolutely remarkable.
Right. But this guy's only living for a couple days under normal circumstances.
Right. They live a couple of weeks. But, yeah, that's why I don't think, you know, they're much simpler than we. They have less than 1,000 cells. And they also have a kind of a hibernation period that probably we can tap into to extend their life, which is one of the reasons I don't think we're going to be able to do quite as well with humans. But in mice, you know, reasonably close relatives, we've been able to extend life by 50 to 75%. So that seems to me something that we could potentially do in people.
You've got a bet going with one of your colleagues about the upper limit, don't you?
Yes, but it's a very conservative bet in these terms. The bet is that there's a person who will live to be 150 years old that is alive today, and that's about 28 years longer than anyone's lived yet. And I think this bet is a done deal. I think I'm going to win easily early, and I'm looking to double it if I can.
Well, how old?
The question is, when will you know?
Well, I probably won't know. The way the bet's constructed, in the year 2150, a group of scientists comes together and determines whether there's actually been at least one 150-year-old person that's, you know, cognitively intact and can carry on a conversation. And if so, then my descendants, or in the best case, I will receive all the accrued money.
I think you got a winner, and my relief is immense.
Right. Well, what are the stakes here?
The stakes? Well, it depends on how you look at it.
For humanity, I can tell that the stakes are large. But for you personally, are you? How do you solve this? What do you win if you win?
Probably about $500 million is our latest calculation. Now, I am an academic, so we haven't put all the money up front. What we've done is we put $150 up front, and we're trusting on the miracle of compound interest to turn that into $500 million in 150 years.
What are some of the strategies for lengthening life, apart from changing a single base pair in the genome?
Well, there's a whole variety of genes that we've been able to change to extend life. The other big treatment that seems to work across a lot of species is to simply cut the amount of calories that individuals eat. And we know that extends life in flies and in these worms and in mice and in rats, and we hope that it might similarly do so in people.
Interesting. You know, I wonder, when you hear this kind of research being described, Dr. Kennedy, do you feel that as the editor of Science Magazine, you should be doing something to encourage this kind of work or push it forward, or do you just take whatever comes in over the transom and that's what gets published if it's top quality work?
No, I think we try to focus some on fields that are especially exciting or are of great interest for reasons that have to do with the human condition and our capacity to do good medicine. I thought his point about dietary restriction is an interesting one, because the lesson from fruit flies, at least, is not only does dietary restriction work to extend lifespan, but even if you started late, it works to extend lifespan almost as much as if you started in the beginning.
Well, that's very good news. But how do you test these things in people, Dr. Austad?
Well, I think that's a critical issue, because if we had something that we thought worked and we started giving it to people, it would be very difficult to see an effect within less than 40 or 50 years. On the other hand, I think the way it's going to go is I think we're going to develop some small primates that only live 15 to 20 years, and those animals should be able to see an effect, whether something affects the primates, reasonably quickly, and then whatever it is could move into human trials.
But there are some human trials of caloric restriction, aren't there?
There are some beginning trials, mainly focused on whether, first of all, people can do it, because that's a real issue. I mean, I don't think people, generally, are going to be able to eat 30% less than they want to eat. I think the obesity statistics show us that already. But this is really a mechanism to try to figure out how it works. But these people, they're looking at short-term measures of increase in something like cardiovascular health, blood pressure, and at least the early results look really quite promising.
All right. Let's see what our listeners have to say on these topics and related ones. I'd like to go to Mark in San Antonio. Mark, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. By the way, I am eating 30% less now that I've turned 52, and I'm looking and feeling much better. Before I ask my brief question, I want to say that I feel it's an interesting coincidence that in the face of this G8 summit and the fact that all the nations, including Great Britain, were and are at odds with George Bush, one of the many effects of global warming is an increase in number and strength of hurricanes, and it is further ironic that the first of these will be hitting Florida. My question is, what parts of the scientific community addresses health issues such as poor diet and exercise and the possibility that the pharmaceutical industry is pursuing treatment of symptoms rather than cures? And do you know of any resistance in revealing this kind of information coming from the current administration?
Interesting. Well, Dr. Kennedy, you might have some perspective on that, having dealt with the pharmaceutical industry in your career.
Not much, actually. I certainly the pharmaceutical industry is looking to improve not only longevity, but more particularly the quality of life at the end of life. I think one of the deep questions about longevity increase is how much of it do we want if it's really bad? That is, if you want to extend life, but only the part in which we're pretty uncomfortable and often pretty unhappy, that doesn't sound like a very good deal.
Yeah. We're talking with Donald Kennedy. He's the editor-in-chief of Science Magazine, and Steve Austad, who's an aging researcher at the university, not an aging researcher, but an aging researcher at the University of Texas Health Sciences. I'm on a roll here. Don't interrupt. At the University of Texas Health Sciences Center in San Antonio, I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Well, Dr. Ostad, actually, that's an interesting point. I mean, what if this person that you, the hypothetical person who's alive today, lives to be 150, but the period of time from, you know, 107 to 150, that last 43 years is spent on your back with the help breathing and assisted feeding and all this other stuff?
Yeah, that would clearly not be good. And that's, you know, we usually talk about extending longevity as a kind of shorthand. What we really mean is extending human life. Nobody, I think, would be in favor of extending the period of disability and dependency at the end of life. The interesting thing is that almost all of the animal work shows that what you're really doing is improving health throughout the lifespan when you extend life, and that you're not really just delaying death, but making animals more and more and more decrepit. That's something we need to be alert to, though, as we work on these therapies.
So when you were talking about these C. elegans, these little worms that were living longer, were they living, I don't want to say happy long lives, but whatever you can call happy for a tiny worm, were they living healthy lives for this longer life?
Well, it's one of the things that's difficult to ask in a 1 millimeter long worm. They seem to move more vigorously, but I think we can begin to answer this in something like a mouse, where we can actually measure a whole lot of aspects of its health. And in calorically restricted mice, or the mice that have had their genes altered so that they live longer, they seem to keep a longer, better immune system, better mental functioning, better physical functioning. All of these things. So that's at least promising.
Okay. Dr. Ostad, Steve Ostad, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Stephen Ostad is the author of Why We Age, What Science is Discovering About the Body's Journey Through Life, out in 1997 by Wiley. He's a professor at the Barshop Institute for Longevity and Aging Studies at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. And we're continuing to talk this hour with Donald Kennedy. He's the editor-in-chief of Science Magazine. And science has come up with this 125 great questions facing science, and then there are 25 that they spend particular time on asking, you know, these are the 25 that might be settled in the next 25 years. But one question that came to mind as I reviewed these is, how open do you think the scientific community is to ideas that are outside the mainstream? I mean, peer review is this notion that scientists will look at work and decide whether it's any good, but some people say, well, it only allows in ideas that are already acceptable, if you know what I mean.
Well, I do, and we worry about the process a lot at science. I think we urge reviewers, and that we urge authors to take some risks. We try, as editors, to take some risks ourselves. But I think it's a fair criticism that any science sort of tends to internalize its basic constructs and to say, well, ideas that fall outside that cabined domain are going to need extra hard scrutiny, and probably we may do too much of that.
But do you think a really bold new idea would be recognized, or would it have to persist for a while before people would accept it?
Any bold new idea that really bumps up against some concepts that are already pretty well demonstrated is going to have a hard time being accepted. And I think the way it gets accepted is that you publish it, and then people start to try to repeat it, and they see whether the outcome can be confirmed.
Okay.
And that's the way science works.
We're talking this hour about the big questions in science, and my guest is Donald Kennedy, editor-in-chief of the journal Science in Washington, D.C. And now we're going to turn to a rather interesting new development in something that may provide some of the answers to some of the big questions, and it has to do with a comet. The comet is Tempel 1, and our guest is Michael Ahern. He's the principal investigator for the Deep Impact mission. That's the one that sent a large probe pummeling into the comet earlier this week, and a flash that literally was seen from millions of miles away, including telescopes here on Earth, I believe, but Dr. Ahern will clear us up on that. He's a professor of astronomy at the University of Maryland in College Park, and he joins me today from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where the mission is being controlled. Welcome, Dr. Ahern.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being here. And boy, this has been one heck of a week for you, huh?
It sure has. It's been incredibly hectic and incredibly exciting.
So we talked to Dr. Yeomans last week when everybody was, you know, we were in the nail-biting stage. But the probe was pretty much right on target, wasn't it?
It was absolutely on target. It hit in an ideal position for us to view what happened from the flyby spacecraft. We couldn't have asked for more in delivering the impactor onto the comet.
Although you had to do a little bit of last-minute tweaking of the trajectory, from what I read.
Well, the impactor itself was pre-programmed to do a few maneuvers, and it had a very robust scheme for picking an area that would be well sunlit and would be biased towards the side where the flyby would look at it. And that algorithm, which was all autonomous, seems to have worked perfectly.
So, we're talking this hour about the big questions in science. What was the big question that Deep Impact was intended to address?
Well, there were two big questions. What's the difference in the composition inside and outside the comet? In other words, how much has the surface changed due to heating by sunlight? And how is the comet put together? Because both of those questions place constraints on how the planets formed 4.5 billion years ago, the comets being the pieces that went together to make the cores of all the giant planets, Jupiter out to Neptune. And we were we had a spectrometer to look at the composition, and we have imagers that study the impact event. We've already got some answers, but clearly there's a tremendous amount of data analysis yet to be done before we get to all the answers.
So what are you able to analyze? You see a big flash of light, and what do you see in that flash that enables you to understand the answers to the questions you're looking for?
Well, for example, what we look at is the debris that's excavated from the crater, and that forms a cone. And if the cone seems to stay attached to the surface all the way through the event, that tells us the material is very weak. It has almost no strength. If the cone lifts up off the surface, that tells us it has a lot of strength. Now, when we turned around from the backside and looked back at the nucleus, it appeared that the cone was still attached to the surface up to 90 minutes later. And that tells us that the material is extremely weak, and in fact weaker probably than the limits that were obtained from the fact that Jupiter could pull apart comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 by tidal effects.
Huh. And so what does that tell you about the origin of the solar system?
Well, that tells us that when things came together in the early solar system, they did not come together at high enough velocity. They didn't come together hard enough or get squeezed enough to, for example, melt and connect the tiny microscopic particles together with the strength of ice. That is the first obvious conclusion. Now, it's clearly going to be a long time before we work out any more details than that very qualitative assessment.
I got it. Okay. Dr. Kennedy, do you think I should extract a promise from you now to publish all this exciting data when it's finally ready for publication?
Well, I'm very hesitant about prior promises, but we'd love to see it. We would surely love to see it. I have a little policy sidebar on that. I think that's a huge triumph of robotic space exploration, like Cassini, like the Mars Explorers. But we now have a major human exploration project announced, and NASA is now trying to put together its priorities in the face of a huge new expenditure and see how much of these important robotic missions it can still afford. And I think that's a deep question, and it's producing some morale problems at NASA.
Right, right. Dr. Ahern, yours was one of the I think I remember one of these smaller, faster, easier spacecraft to be put together. It was a smaller project anyway, as these
smaller
projects go.
Yes, smaller and faster, but definitely not easier.
Okay. But, is this the kind of thing, do you think this is the reward, the scientific reward for this is going to be as large as Dr. Kennedy thinks?
Oh, I think absolutely. There are a few kinds of science that are better done by humans in space, but not very many. And having the humans in space is important for inspiration, but the science is far more cost-effectively done in most cases with robotic missions.
Right. And what can this mission, the Deep Impact mission, talk about how life arose on Earth? Is there any connection there?
Well, many of us, although certainly not all of us, think that comets delivered most of the water and all the organic material to the Earth that enabled life to exist here. There was some contribution undoubtedly from primitive asteroids in the outer part of the asteroid belt. But many of us think that the cometary contribution was the dominant one. So anything we can learn about the nature of comets will tell us about the nature of the material that was brought to Earth to enable life.
Okay. We have a comet question, I think, from Don in Rockford, Michigan. Is it, Don? Welcome to the program.
Sir. Hi. Thank you very much.
Sure.
And I apologize, I'm terrible with names, but the gentleman from NASA, is it?
Michael Ahern. No, he's from the University of Maryland, but he's working with NASA on this mission.
I just wanted to congratulate you. This was a spectacular mission.
Thank you.
I've been following this one and Huygens. You were involved in Huygens as well, weren't you, on the imaging team?
No, I was not on Huygens at all.
Oh, okay, then I'm nuts. In any case, I wondered a couple of things. One, the fact that we didn't get a really good picture of the impact crater going to affect the data that you get back from this.
Well, the fact that we didn't get, at least we haven't yet gotten a good picture of the impact crater, is interesting in itself. It says that the amount of material that came out of the crater was in much finer particles than many of us had expected, and therefore it was much brighter and much more opaque, so that we were looking through a reasonably thick cirrus cloud in order to see the crater. So although we don't have the crater, we have alternative information that is equally interesting.
And when you said yet, I'm just sorry, I want to, if you don't mind, Don, there's hope for getting one of these pictures still?
We're still working on trying to extract an image of the crater. We know exactly where the impactor went in from the images on the impactor itself. So we know exactly where on the nucleus to look. And it requires very high signal-to-noise ratio in the images and then very careful processing to find something through this cloud of material. So what we're working on right now is improving the calibration of the images to remove some additional noise. And I think there is still hope that of us getting an image of the crater. It won't be a really spectacular sharp image because of the cloud of dust in front of it, but we are still optimistic that we will get a picture eventually.
And Don, you had one other question?
Yes, sir. This is probably more for Dr. Kennedy, but a general question about astronomy and physics. I haven't had a chance to see your list yet. Is there anybody considering the issue of entropy?
And
it is. Question. I mean,
I think
Don, I'm sorry. Sorry, our caller Don is breaking up, so I'm going to just see if we can move on to getting Dr. Kennedy's answer. If you can address that.
Well, I think physicists think about entropy. Physicists and physical chemists think about the entropy all the time. I don't think there's a particular project aimed at some particular target.
Okay. I think we have time for one more comet-related question. Mike in St. Louis, welcome to the program. Mike, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, good.
I first of all, I'm really grateful to be a human being and vulnerable as such. But why are we trying to send human beings into outer space when clearly we're heading towards virtuality, and that's a real issue for the future, is who we're going to be and how we're going to achieve this transition. But spending money into the future to send humans into outer space to just do observations, I think, is a ridiculous waste of money. And I'd like your comment from anybody there who might want to address that.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. Why don't I put Dr. Ahern on the spot? You already sort of answered this by talking about the symbolism of men in space, or humans in space, I should say.
Yeah. I think there is an important aspect to human exploration. So I think the real question is, what fraction of NASA's budget do you spend on it? I think we learn more from the robotic science, but the human role has to be there eventually. And I think it is perfectly reasonable to spend a fraction of NASA's budget on human exploration. But human exploration means going places. And
yep.
Then I think we should be spending a very large fraction of the budget on the robotic missions, which tell us our place in the universe.
Okay. Well, Dr. Ahern, thank you very much for joining us today. I'm sure this is an exciting time, and I'm glad that you took the time out to talk with us before you race back to the control room or wherever you're doing the analysis.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye. Michael Ahern is principal investigator for the Deep Impact mission and a professor of astronomy at the University of Maryland in College Park. I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking for the rest of the hour with Donald Kennedy. He's the editor-in-chief of Science Magazine in Washington, D.C. And I was going to ask you, Dr. Kennedy, has science taken an editorial position on this question of whether, you know, the human space program is the right way to be spending the nation's money?
I sign the editorials on this particular subject at Science, and the editorial position has been simply this. We've got a huge new program to send people to Mars via the moon. Obviously, there's excitement in that adventure because, after all, exploration is part of the human narrative. On the other hand, it's going to cost a great deal of money, and there are a lot of explorations that are primarily robotic that are planned for both planetary science and for explorations of deep space, to which, by the way, we will never plan to send anybody, at least not in the foreseeable future, because if they go out there, they're not coming back.
Yeah.
The planetary explorations, I think, obviously attract the interest of people who are excited by human exploration. The question is, how much money do you want to divert from other things to pay for that? And I think that's a tough question, and it's bothering a lot of people at NASA.
But let's go one step beyond that. The balance is interesting between physical research and biological research. I mean, even an inexpensive mission in NASA terms is several hundred million dollars, and there's a lot of biological research that can be done for that amount of money. So how do you feel that balance is?
Well, let me stick with NASA and NASA work for a moment, because, in fact, one of the projects that has been talked about for some time is Earth-observing satellites and an Earth observation program. We can learn a lot about the biology that happens in the skin of our own Earth. And that's one of the projects that may well be in jeopardy as a consequence of the cost of the new Mars mission.
So, but more generally, even than that, is the balance, if you were looking at the U.S. science scene, I mean, we've just signed on, for example, to ITER, this international thermonuclear fusion generator. These are huge, expensive projects, and of course we all remember the superconducting supercollider, which was going to answer fundamentally important questions, but we decided we couldn't afford it. Are we missing something in our balance of research dollars because we see some projects as very expensive and others being, you know, smaller and easier to fund?
I think we've done pretty well at maintaining a balance in the past. I have some skepticism about big fusion expenditures, but others think it's very worthwhile. I'm not smart enough to know. The real difficulty, it seems to me, is deciding how to allocate between basic research and more applied projects. That's one kind of allocation trauma. And the other is to decide between big project science and small project science. And we're getting more and more interdisciplinary. I think that came out earlier in the show. And as that happens, more and more work requires teams, and more work requires fairly substantial facilities allocations. And so maintaining that balance is difficult. I think we've done a reasonably good job of it in the past. But there will always be some competition between the investigator-initiated, independent, smaller research projects that have yielded a good deal in the past and big project work.
Okay, Donald Kennedy, that's where we have to leave things. Thanks very much for joining me.
It was a pleasure, Joe.
Donald Kennedy is editor-in-chief of the journal Science in Washington, D.C.
Thanks for listening. Remember to visit sciencefriday.com for more information on this topic and every topic we talk about on Science Friday. See you next time. I'm Ira Flatow.